Hey guys, welcome to an all-new Artsy Fartsy Immigrants. Today we have a very special guest, the long-awaited, very kind, very hilarious, Laura Ramoso. Enjoy. Really happy that you are on here. I've hyped like having you on this little podcast for so long now.
Oh my god, I'm so happy to be here. Don't call it little. It's the biggest podcast in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
pushing Joe Rogan like off the cliff where he belongs.
Oh yeah, no, he's done. He belongs in the ocean.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, so you're. You know, you lived in Canada for a long time, but so let's just start like from total scratch. I mean, we know each other a little bit from the internet now. I've been watching your videos for a long time. You've grown this huge audience as a sketch comedian and content creator, actress. But I want to know a little bit like, you know, I know your mom worked at the World Health Organization.
Yeah.
So, where were you born and, you know, where did that take you? Because I think that's a big part of your story, right?
Yeah, totally. So I, as we all know, my mom's German and my dad's Italian. And I was born in Italy, in Legnago, in the mid-90s. And because my mom worked for the World Health Organization, we moved around a lot. So before I turned a year old, we'd moved to Cameroon in West Africa, in Douala, Cameroon. We lived there for 6 years. Then we moved to Azerbaijan for 3 years. Then we did China for 5. And then we did Vietnam for 3. And that's when I graduated from high school and I decided to move to Canada to pursue further studies. And my parents kept traveling. And through this sort of upbringing, we would go back to Germany or Italy, mostly Italy, to be honest, in the summers and for Christmas. And then back to where my mom was stationed. So that's kind of my childhood. They call it a third culture kid upbringing.
Yeah, it's very international school story in a sense.
Totally. Yeah.
There's so many Americans living in Munich that I've met who all kind of have the similar story of like a military parent. You know, when you tell the story of moving around so much, do you get asked if you're in this situation too? Sorry.
Yes, no, you're totally right. And I went to school with a number of military kids as well. So it's either that sort of family or people who work in global health or stuff like that. Very much same international school vibe.
Did these like first countries in your youth have any effect on you, you think? Did you grab anything or was it too young, you think?
I mean, they definitely had an effect. This upbringing had a big effect on me, I would say, in many ways. For comedy specifically, or the way that my comedy kind of was born, because I love to do observational comedy, like very day-to-day people you meet or the situations you find yourself in. You know, I kind of don't do political stuff or any of the big like commentary on macro things. And I think, yeah, right. And I think, I don't know how it is for you, but I think it's because when I was growing up in all of these different cultures and with all these different people from many different backgrounds, we hardly had much in common except the kind of normal things that happen to us on the day-to-day that are sort of universal human experiences. So we related over those things, you know, like what our parents were like and like stuff like that. So I think that's why I enjoy doing observational comedy.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely makes sense that that's kind of an origin story for that. So you were only going to Canada originally because you wanted to go to school there.
Yes, I wanted to go to university in Canada. I wanted to go to university in North America. I'd never lived in North America, and I was sort of infatuated by it through, you know, those movies, North the college experience, and I wanted the red solo cup and the parties and the U.S. scared me It was intimidating. So I thought Canada seemed pretty good.
There's a lot more guns. There's a lot more guns in the States. Like so many guns, like way more guns than you'd think.
Exactly. And
how did you land on the university? Like, how did you find the university that you wanted to go to?
Okay. So I went to the University of Victoria in Victoria, BC, British Columbia. And they had a theater program that I really liked. And I was in my counselor's office in high school and I saw a poster of the campus on her wall and I thought it looked really beautiful. And I don't know, that sounds like a stupid story, I think, to just see a poster, but it worked out and it was good. It ended up working out and the theater program was good. So that's how I chose. I don't know. My parents think it's because I wanted to be as far away as possible from where they were.
Parents would think that. I mean, that's kind of what they would. That's kind of what they do. But I don't think I don't think that's so irrational. I think a lot of things are chosen based off of like the simplest instincts sometimes. You know, I mean, the only reason like you did a theater program and I did a film program, so it's not too far apart there. But like literally the only reason why I chose the school that I went to, the University of New Orleans, is because my dad had basically moved us to Louisiana. And my goal and dream and passion, like, would die on this hill, like, so intense, you know, teenager dream.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to be like a Wes Anderson. Like, I'm going to be a writer, director, you know. At the time, I didn't even think about, front of camera stuff at all.
Yeah.
You know, that was later in college. Like, and we'll talk about that, like, joining improv groups and stuff. But, But, like, I went to the school. And I met the director of the program and he just walked me and my dad around and it was just like the basics, like here's our editing bay, here's our, you know, our equipment room. You just like guys like roping up cables and shit. And then we just walked around, there was a cinema. They had just installed like a 4K cinema and I just had these
Google
eyes, you know? And
cables. You're like a bay. Editing bay.
What is an XLR?
Oh my God. I know.
And I remember like my dad and I have always had a very rocky relationship, but I'll never forget, we were talking to the director of the department, and I remember like he wasn't trying to like get us to sign anything that day. He was really cool actually. He was maybe in his 60s at the time, and my dad told him in front of me, I saw the look on my son's face. I think we're going to be like signing the program. Like I think we're going to go here, no doubt, you know. And it was just that simple. Like I just saw the cinema and was like, I want to go here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you kind of have to have that mindset at that age. You kind of have to have starry eyes to pursue it. I think it's
you have to be necessary. Delusional to pursue entertainment.
I agree. Seeing it really loud in the mic.
I mean, like my mom said something the other day that rang so true because she's always been very supportive and my dad was too, but it's just different. And she was always been very supportive, but she told me something that was kind of a truth that I always assumed, but was never like clarified very openly. But on my last episode of this podcast, I did like a quick just solo thing kind of talking about what's going on. And I had talked about some of the videos and like kind of where they're going. And I was so happy with things and how they're going. And my mom wrote me a really nice message. And she said, we're so happy that you're getting to like make kind of a living off of something you enjoy doing so much. We were always worried that wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know,
that's a really nice message.
It was really nice. She's the queen of little sweet messages like that. Were you a theater kid in school? Like was that theater something that interested you before university?
Yes. Big theater kid, big drama kid. I did all the plays, all the musicals. I'm not a singer, but sometimes I don't know why high schools love to do really big, ambitious musicals. So I just did every one that I could and I loved drama class and it was my favorite class. Yeah.
What would you say? Like, I mean, now you're doing something so like connected to that. Definitely. We'll get to your stage, performances and things like that. But you know, when you were having these passions for theater before you knew you would end up in Canada, what were some, you know, what were some plays or what were some playwrights or actresses or actors that you, you know, idolized?
So I definitely, this'll fit into the comedy of it. My first comedy education and stage, oh, did it cut out? No, it didn't. I'm going to say that again. This fits into comedy because my first comedy education slash theater education at all was watching the Italian sketch comedy trio Aldo, Giovanni, Giacomo. They're really popular in Italy, and they did TV sketches, but they also did these incredible live shows, and I idolized them and redid their sketches for my parents all the time. And that was kind of the first stage and comedy performance I ever watched that made me go, wow, that's really incredible. Other than that, I think I was into whatever we were doing at the time. I mean, we did Grease, the high school version. Of course, now, you know, you ask me this question, I've forgotten every single name of play that I've ever done, but... my first show I ever did was Jack and the Beanstalk, and I was a narrator, and I had to have my script on stage with me because I couldn't remember my lines. I got more professional as time went on, but that was really...
Was narrator an onstage role, or was it off to the side?
It was on stage, and I was one of three parrots. I don't know why Jack and the Beanstalk, the famous farm animal story, had parrots in it, tropical parrots.
Of course.
That was fun. We got to wear colorful costumes.
I love that sort of stuff where it's always like the high school position always has things that would probably be better or more fitting just not on the stage, but because every kid has to have a place on the stage, they're like, you know, you could just read it here with this lamp and this desk off off stage, but you're in high school, so you're going to be an exotic parrot.
There's just like 126 kids on this one stage, and
It's so
crazy. Huge production for high school. Yeah. That's basically how it started.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, and I guess you were, I mean, how were you getting your, I mean, I guess it's probably just the internet, but I was going to say, how were you getting this inspiration and this entertainment living in so many different places? Was it probably just your dad showing you things? I wanted to ask, actually, because we are in Germany, were there German comedians as well or sketch writers that you found or not
at
all?
No, you know, unfortunately, not at all. And that's not a comment on German comedy. You can take it if it is. No, it's because my dad... Yeah, you can... my dad was very interested in comedy and very interested in, he went to theater school too in his 30s and he was a part of a troupe when he was young. So he was interested in showing me. And my mom, she worked a lot and my dad spent a lot of time with me watching stuff. So we watched Tom and Jerry. Mr. Bean was a big thing for us. Aldo, Giovanni, Giacomo. So mainly those are the first influences, and it was from my dad. Yeah,
I think Mr. Bean is probably, man, he's maybe the most like inspirational first person in my whole world, you know.
Yes,
because he connects, like he doesn't need words, so anybody of any language of any age can understand like perfect, well-crafted slapstick, you know.
Yes.
Oh my God, I was watching Mr. Bean at such a young age, and I don't even remember how I came across it, but in like 2018, 2019, I had a day job at this elementary school in Munich, and it was like an international bilingual school.
Yeah.
And they even showed, like during recess or, you know, whatever, some sort of party or break, they would show these Mr. Bean compilations of like different sketches sort of thread together. And it was so, like, so amazing to see these new, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 year old kids, like very, very young. Oh no, I guess it'd be 6 through 9, but like 6, 7, 8 year old kids just laughing, like belly laughing at something that's first off like 35 years old or more at this point, you know, and remembering laughing when I was their age.
Yeah.
Is there someone like Mr. Bean? I mean, You mentioned already the Italian group, but is there someone like Mr. Bean in that way that you have just through and through since you were a kid will always laugh at anything they do if you see something like a TikTok video of like, you know, some clip, you know?
Yeah. This came later, but Kristen Wiig, I will always laugh.
Kristen Wiig is like God. She's God.
Yeah, she's God. She owns the heavens. Bill Hader too.
But this generation of SNL, was this, I mean, were you too young to catch that group? Were you at the precipice of them changing out? Or was that, you know, the Hader, Wiig, Armisen, Tom, like Keenan, like were you able to catch that group as it came on?
No, I only started to watch SNL when I was like later when I was in university. And I think some of them had already started trickling out, but I would just rewatch them on YouTube and stuff.
Was something
that
like
that whole generation is very good.
Oh my God. I mean, they always say that your favorite SNL cast is the one that you were watching when you were in high school.
Right.
Which checks out, of course. I think that's similar to also music that you can always listen to, you know.
Agree.
For the most part. I mean, we had, you know, I was born in 90, so there's plenty of emo and stuff I wouldn't listen to now, like Simple Plan or whatever. but this cast, like Kristen Wiig, Jason Sudeikis, Bill Hader, like that was so pristine. And then getting Armisen to go into Portlandia. Mm-hmm. Like this group was just like it was the perfect into college group that I mean for me it's I can always watch that group. I can always watch it. There's no bad skit.
Yeah, me too. And I always love to watch their interviews too. They're just wonderful.
Yeah.
Are really wonderful performers.
You know, I didn't realize how recently actually some of your progress was, because if you watch your videos, it does seem that you've been doing what you're doing right now with Francis and with the digital creation, like you've been doing it just like this for 10 years or something. It comes across very, very like polished, which, you know, shows your
is a
representation of your professionalism with that. But I didn't realize that just as far back as like 2017, you saw this Second City show. Let's talk about improv. Let's talk about Second City. Where were you and how was that for you?
So I was still in Victoria and I graduated from theater school and I didn't really know what I was going to do. I mean, comedy was still not in my brain at all. I always kind of thought I'd be more of a dramatic classical actor. And even though I enjoyed the comedic roles and the comedic plays a lot more, I just thought that was just what you would enjoy more anyway. So honestly, after theater school, I thought, what am I going to do to continue my education? And then my mom wanted me to get a master's degree, as any German mom would. And
for sure.
Yeah. So I was like, where can I do that, but then also fulfill this creative desire? And I thought I would audition for Juilliard. And I did it 1 year. I went through a couple rounds and then I was not in. And then the second year in a row that I auditioned, I actually went to Chicago to do the audition. Bombed it. Horrible. Worst audition ever done in my life. However, when I was in Chicago, I thought, because I'd heard about the Second City kind of, and I knew it was comedy. So I decided to go watch a show at that same trip. And I don't know. I don't know if you believe in destiny.
the eye roll. Oh my God.
I know. I don't know. I don't know if you do. I find it interesting.
Some things are definitely unexplainable in that, like, they can't just all be chaos all the time. Like, chaos means some things match up in such a perfect way, you know?
Yeah. And it's that whole thing when one door closes, another one opens, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So I went to see this show and it was like the best show I'd ever seen in my life. And I'd never seen comedy like that. And I never knew sketch comedy could be that way. And in that moment, in that theater, I was like, oh, this is exactly what I want to do. So then I was like, where do I move? That's still not the States because I still wanted to stay in Canada. Toronto had a Second City. Still has one, but at the time was the only other city outside the States that had one. So then I moved to Toronto and started my comedy education. And then also because German mom still was like, you need to get a master's degree. So then I went to get a business degree on the side. I went to get my MBA in entertainment management. But I started doing comedy, learning, doing, and then like every class I could take, I took improv. Yeah, so I'd love to talk. I mean, improv, sketch, writing, everything. I just did everything.
This is such like a major part of my identity as a human on this weird earth. Like something about Second City, Groundlings. Do you know the ASCAT? You know ASCAT?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, finding that DVD of the perfect Amy Poehler performance, you know.
Yeah.
Seeing that at this pivotal age. I think I saw that when I was 17 at this rental store in my hometown. And like seeing these people do things I didn't know that you did.
Yeah.
You know, I of course, you know, growing up in the States, I knew SNL since I was born, but I didn't know what happens before that.
I
didn't even like have the capacity to think about what they must be able to do before they get there.
Yes.
You know, maybe they're stand-ups or maybe they're writers, but my brain wasn't even thinking about that. It was just like, oh, there's Adam Sandler. Cool. There's David Spade. He's sarcastic. I like that or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
And so how much they have to learn to be able to unlearn it and make it look totally natural. Like that was the biggest, like a huge thing for me when I was going through it as well. So just, yeah, big, huge moment. And I can see for you as well.
This is going to sound pretty inside baseball for people who have never been in theater improv, but do you have a personal preference between long form things like Harold or short form things a bit more in the vein of like Whose Line Is It Anyway, something like that?
I prefer long form.
Yeah.
I think long form has
a bigger payoff. It's
like huge payoff, more groundwork and more patience, but I think huge payoff. And I think the funnest thing to see, like not fun to watch if done poorly, but like the greatest thing if done really well.
Yeah, that's true.
The best show I've ever seen in my life was the Improvised Shakespeare Company in San Francisco. And they do like an improvised Shakespearean play in iambic pentameter. And it's rhymes and it's off suggestions and it's narrative Shakespeare and also just in the moment. And it is,
oh my God,
insane. It's absolutely crazy. It's the amount of work that goes into being able to perform that kind of show is massive, but then you and now that they've perfected it, it's like the most magical thing ever. I think it can feel like magic.
Is there like is there a YouTube video of one of their shows maybe somewhere?
Yeah, Shakespeare. I'll send it to you. I'll send it to you.
I have to see that because that's mind blowing. That's like, it's already difficult enough.
Yeah.
You know, to be so, and the thing was like, you know, I'm a little scatterbrained, but being on stage in any capacity, whether that was in my case like originally music or when I was in college, it was always improv shows with our group of like between 5 and 8 people as the time went on. But like being on that stage, you have to be so present. There isn't like an opportunity for you to daydream. And if you do, if you just happen to have something else on your mind, like fighting with a partner or someone you had who cares, something on your mind, that can threaten so much the story and the thing you're building, and it will threaten what you're supposed to set up for your team to such an extent.
Oh, yeah.
And like in your brain learns how to, no matter what, shut off everything else. It's like the feeling of like not just, you know, silencing your phone, but turning it off and leaving it like in this bucket at the airport, like just off. There's this feeling of like ultimate freedom. Time feels different. You're like, in my case, it was like I felt this kind of confidence because I knew that I was like this slippery little ghost that could just step into absolutely anybody's shoes. I could be the janitor. I could be the president.
Yeah.
I could be, you know, whatever, him, his real name, whatever. It was just this freedom to be there and be present and be in it. And I owe so much of like what little kind of comedy intuition I might have from our old improv troop leader. His name was Corey Dumasnil. And he just, you know, he was a big Scott Ackerson Is he from oh no, what is it? Comedy Bang Bang. Comedy Bang Bang.
Okay, yeah.
Scott Akerson is like this, he's like the improv comedian's improv comedian sort of thing, like more behind the scenes. But he had this Comedy Bang Bang show and podcast. But he was such like a student of him, and he brought into our group so many ways of thinking that I had just never thought of before, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really incredible. An old instructor of mine who actually ended up being the director for Francis, it described being in an improv scene like this. Like you have, now you can cut to video if you want. You have this going on and then you have this going on. So then you've got you in the scene or your character and that character in the scene and you're present in the scene. And then you also have to be kind of on top as Laura, the improviser, surveying the scene and making decisions on the macro level. Like, where do I take this later? Or, you know, what does this mean for such and such character, or where can we go from here? Yeah, very, very much need to be present. And I'm glad that it did such positive things for you, because it did for me, and I'm sure it does for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think it's funny how, I think we both have kind of a whole life switch due to what we were forced to do during the pandemic. But even despite that, it's so funny to look at how things just change and are kind of out of your control to an extent. As long as you're giving whatever it is you're doing, like your all, that's your part of the control. But it's so funny, like even, you know, whatever it was at the time, music for a long time was like the number one thing. And then now I'm in a position where I'm reconnecting with so many parts of myself that I have neglected since college. You know?
Right.
It's so interesting to relive that. But so tell me a little bit, like, so pre-pandemic, what is Diane? How did you come up with it? What's the roots of it? You know, let's talk about Diane.
Yeah. So after I'd been in Toronto for a while and like did all the classes and, you know, joined the improv and sketch teams and blah, blah, blah. After a while, you start to produce, you know, you either get on other people's shows or you produce your own once you get a little bit more confident. And I fell in love with solo sketch. I fell in love with solo performance in theater school, but solo sketch was very interesting to me. I loved doing character monologues on my own and other things like that. So then I thought I would challenge myself and do a show. I asked a director to join me, Devin Highland, and I named it Diane because every character in the show's name was Diane, and and they're all different characters, but the whole premise was that, like, the first Diane needs to figure out which Diane she's going to be that day, and then we go, and then it's like a sketch show with a bunch of different characters, and at the end, she makes her decision. But that was the first show I did. It was in 2019, and it was just really great experience, and then I took it to some festivals.
It was very well received, right? I mean,
it was
not, I mean, I think it's like the first solo show in 15 years to win that Best of Fest at the Toronto Festival. I mean, that's, how was that for you also as a woman and a comedian to have that sort of success with your first show like that?
It was really special. It was a really, really, I remember it. It's hard to look back now because so much has happened, but I remember that time being such a special memory because I had worked so hard for so long, and I ended up making a show that I really wanted to make and that felt good for me to perform, as opposed to trying to do something that I thought other people would like, which has always been the marker for me. Sometimes when I look back and I remember times where I created things for other people or made or presented myself in a way that I thought was funny, it's always best to just do what feels good. And that was the first time I ever really did that. And the fact it was then well received was just the cherry on top. I couldn't have been more proud and happy at that time. Yeah.
Did your German mother give you some sort of acceptance with that?
yeah, she did. I think she loves like fat. She loves like hard, like if hard markers of success, if that makes sense.
I think all parents appreciate when something's undeniable, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I wanted to ask, actually, with something like Diane, comparing styles of performance, would you say that doing it, let's say you do it five nights in a row at something like the festival that you're about to do, is it more in the vein of a play where it's very scripted and you stick to what you know is going to work because you've practiced it and beaten it to like this perfect sculpture? Or is it a bit more in the vein of stand-up where you allow small changes to be improvised in the moment each time?
Is it annoying if I say it's both? Because a sketch, so it's very scripted and jokes are written and we know what's happening at all times. But then there are also sketches that are meant to be fully improvised with a structure.
I see.
Or there's a there's audience participation. So that's also in a large sense improvised. So some sketches are incredibly sturdy and maybe some jokes or delivery changes here and there based on the night.
Right.
But others are meant to be changed. And that's what I love about sketch comedy is how flexible it is. Like if something's not working, you can change it. If something happens in the world, like say you have a sketch about Harry Styles and he does something that day that's like everyone's like, oh my God, he lost this award. Then you can be like, put it in the show because sketch comedy is about the here and the now and the relatability. So that's what I love about it. So it's both, but it is a fully produced show.
So you
it just, some things can change. Yeah.
So you sculpt windows to allow yourself in these pieces to improvise and the rest of it is like the sculpture basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you ever had more of a passion for going into writing, for example, like writing for someone else's show or writing for, and this is just an example, but like being the monologue writer for a late night show? Or has your passion from that Second City show been front of camera on stage?
Oh, yeah. Performance. And even better for me if I can write for myself. Yeah. I enjoy writing for other people, but sometimes, and this is maybe laziness on my part or something I have yet to really master, is I like to write. I know what I want a delivery to be, or I know who this character is. And you wouldn't really read that on the page. You would only know it if you were in my head. And I have a hard time explaining that, which is sometimes why, I think why I love to perform by myself so much. Again, I'm not saying that's a good thing, but that's just the reality. Yeah.
Do you, when you're performing in your videos, but also on your plays and your performances, do you feel more confident being able to control all aspects on your own, or are there people you've worked with before who you can imagine going forward and doing something with?
So when it comes to videos, I like to be completely alone. Most of the time, I have such a hard time with control. I imagine maybe one day that could come bite me in the ass. I'm not sure, but I really just enjoy doing it by myself. For stage shows, it's impossible to do it alone. I mean, you could, but I have a director and then also a tech director who designs the lights and the sound.
Yeah. I meant like on the stage with you. Yeah.
Oh, no, by myself.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, no, that made it easier.
No problem.
Sorry.
No, but I haven't had any experience in the same way that you have with being on stage like that. But with video content, I'm exactly the same way. I feel like I feel like I can't be the level of ridiculous that I need to be in front of someone else.
I completely agree. And I think it's hard to do that unless you started from day one, you know, with that person and you've grown together.
Right.
I have to be a lot. I can't even have my husband be in the same room. Mm-hmm. I can't even. And yeah, totally can be completely free to just let yourself fail or like try something crazy.
Right.
Or, yeah.
Because a lot of that stuff, I mean, maybe we do it similar in that way where like a lot of good ideas that have me laughing at myself is something that I did not plan at all, but comes from something that didn't quite click.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
100%.
Okay, so that was Diane. You had a lot of success with that. You bridged the gap. You built this alone, and you got some return on that. What's next in that story for you? Is it going into pandemic, entering this world where the theater is no longer available to you, and that leads into videos, and then that leads into Francis?
That's totally right. Yeah, Diane, for context, I had received that award from the Toronto Sketch Comedy Festival like in March of 2020, which, you know, is, as everyone knows, what happened? I don't remember.
It was the coolest month of all.
It was the coolest month of all. And so I remember being absolutely devastated at the time, as everybody was, and just traumatized by what was happening. But, you know, everything shut down and I felt like I was on my own little trajectory with them. I mean, I wasn't making a living, but I was learning and I was doing shows and I was taking my steps.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then COVID hit and everything went away. Like everything shut down. Like I'm sure that you also maybe were the same way, but I used to go do improv almost every night of the week. I would hang out with the community all the time and that, and it all went away. And so there was a moment of and trying to find a way to, because I'd been at school, so then I was also finding a job. I got a remote job.
What was the job you were doing? What was the job you were doing at the time?
Real estate marketing.
Real estate marketing? What does that? Yeah. What does that? What? Okay, in your briefest possible way, what does that mean?
Okay, so there's agents. You know, real estate agents, and then there's listings. And so I worked for a company that was like a real estate company that had a bunch of agents in it, and I would do marketing for their for them personally, but also for the company's listings. So social media, web, but also print design, and that whole thing. So for a year.
What is like the agent promotion in something like this compared to promoting the property? Like, are you doing? Like, were you one of the, like, the corporate TikTok social media managers who was, like, getting a real estate agent to do, like, a trending dance or something? Or how did you view it at the time? Because I see that all the time, and it's so crazy.
Yeah. No, it was less that and more, like, so when you, because agents are so personal hires for people, you know, they have to appeal to somebody who's trying to buy or sell very personally. So it was very much about building a personal brand for them and what would their angle be, because who is their target audience. And then in that way, it'd be like producing video interviews for them to post on social media, or copy under their photos, or newsletters, writing their copy for newsletters in the style or of language that would be appropriate for their brand and who they were trying to target.
Were you like pretty successful at that? Like they liked what you did, or did you have some trial and error in that world?
There was some trial and error, but it was very like regular 9 to 5, and I quit because of the things that were growing in my social media world. So I wasn't fired.
Yeah, yeah. So I assumed you left because your career was blowing up. Yeah, sure. How was that feeling for you? And what was your parents' reaction quitting like a reliable job for your acting and your digital creation and your writing? How was that for them? Because I want to hear that.
Yeah. So I had been making videos for a while, all throughout the same time that I had this day job. And it wasn't until I got a social media agent and then I signed for a couple of brand deals that I was doing that at the same time. So then I thought, you know what? I am making I'm making a living with this, with my own social media stuff. And I really don't want to stay in this day job right now, or it wasn't like my dream job anyway. So then I was like, you know what? I'm going to try to do social media full time for the summer and see how it goes. And if it just completely burns away, or if it completely like is a bust, then I'll just get another job in the fall. So I told myself this plan, and then I told my parents this plan, and they were like, okay, good plan. And so it was about being able to prove that I could. It was about being able to prove that I could sustain myself, having already done that, instead of being like, I'm going to quit the day job and see if I can sustain myself. It's more like, I can for this time, and I'm going to try it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, your audience was already growing enough where you were making money from these partnerships, and this was post Diane. So your parents knew that you had the, what do you say? Like, not the wherewithal, but you had the gusto, you had the meat, you know, you could do it.
Yeah.
It just depends if people were grabbing onto it, and they were.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So there was no, I mean, we had a conversation about it, but I don't recall any significant pushback, especially because the day job wasn't like, you know, a dream job for me.
Sure, sure. So. I mean, they knew that. It was like, pandemic was so interesting in that way for me, because for me, it was concerts. You know, it was like really just chasing music. And then that all came to an end. And then I was working on a new album during the downtime, but I was working at this elementary school. I always had day jobs. I'm only now in a position where I don't have one for the first time.
And, congratulations.
Thank you. Like, official.
That's huge.
And I know you did this, I think you did a post last year where you've like officially announced, I think with the audience photo, maybe it was earlier this year. I think it was last year, right? But it was just like, I saw that and I knew, like, it is just when we're creative people like we are, and there's this inescapable itch, right, for the things that we need to do. Whether that's, in your case, being on stage, or if we have even subconscious goals somehow for the attention or for making people laugh because we need to see that, you know, whatever that might be, or just the money, just those cha-ching bags, you know, whatever the goal is, it's still like, such like the most rewarding feeling to finally get to the point where, and like you said in your case as well, being comfortable enough to take the risk to stop the dependency, you know, on the other thing. And I'm so, it's just like, it makes sense in your case, because you had this theater background, you had improv background, you were already writing for yourself, you had an education in this world, you had already done a stage play that was like an award-winning show, you were making these videos. It makes total sense that it leads to a point where like that becomes your career. And that's what's so, it's so cool to see that trajectory, like, you know, just like, it makes sense. I'm still reeling from the fact that whatever I'm doing now with these videos is not at all, not 1% what I had planned for most of my life for myself.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah, and I'm basically just like following who I think is doing good things, and like kind of getting inspired and just trying things.
Yeah, and you gotta. That's really, you just gotta feel, go for what feels good and follow your gut. It's cliche, but it's just the truth.
Where were you in terms of audience? I mean, and we also don't have to talk about this if you don't want, but where were you at audience number-wise when an agency approached you to work together on brand deals? Do you remember?
Oh, I approached them.
Oh, okay.
I was at around, I think, 200,000 on TikTok and less than 100,000 on Instagram.
Okay. And was your, because the experience I had with these two platforms was that when I finally got TikTok, again, like during pandemics when I started doing things differently, the growth there was so substantially faster than the growth I was ever having on Instagram.
Yeah.
But again, different topics, right? I was starting to do comedy and like observational stuff and making fun of German language. And then Instagram was very, very slow, like snail. Did you have a similar story, or was it pretty equal?
Oh, 100%. TikTok was so fast and so much all at once. And then Instagram, magically, I think it wasn't until like even half a year or more later, also started growing. And I don't know if they did anything different with their internal stuff or their algorithm when pushing reels and stuff. But yeah, TikTok was so, so much faster. But now they're pretty much the same for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think now it's like, for me, Instagram is a little more than double for TikTok, which was crazy because,
right.
I mean, TikTok used to be like five times more than whatever
yeah,
I was doing.
Yeah.
It was crazy. Like, I guess you said there's yeah. just like an algorithmic change in whatever they're starting to push.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know.
So how about Francis? Where did you get the idea for it? And, you know, is it like, what is, yeah, tell me about Francis.
So I always knew that I wanted to go do a second show after COVID. And I wanted to, the name comes from, I wanted to continue the trend of doing first names for titles, except Francis is just the name I've always loved and it kind of felt like it stuck. But for this show, instead of it being just a pure sketch show, I wanted to challenge myself and include a narrative arc on top of that as well. So I started working on it at the tail end of the closures when people were starting to say that theaters might open back up again, you know, sprinklings. And then when they did, I booked the theater for August 2022, and then I did it last year.
How was it for you, like, writing-wise to build this arc? Was that more difficult? Was it a good challenge? How was that?
It was hugely difficult. Mm-hmm. It was the hardest thing I've ever done creatively. My whole summer was a disaster. Personally and creatively, academically, socially, culturally. I had a really hard time. But it's kind of always how it goes. It was such a challenge for me, but I'm so happy that I got through it because I'm really happy with what came out at the other end. But it was hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you, when you completed it, when you got that arc finished up, when was it? Was it the first performance? Was it the test run? Or was it just, you know, at home on your computer where you knew it worked?
I didn't know until opening night. Yeah. Because I was so scared. I didn't even run previews. I was like, I can't show anyone the show before opening night because I'm afraid that if they don't like it, then I'm gonna never do it. I don't know. It was a really weird mindset to have, but I didn't know it was gonna work until opening night. And then it did, but changes still had to be made, and it's mm-hmm. constantly changing. Yeah.
I was going to ask what percentage has probably changed since the first reveal, if you think.
If I think, I think probably 20% has changed. Yeah. I mean, the main foundation and structure is still there, but we've swapped out sketches, we've changed jokes, we've cut it, it's been sliced.
How would you compare yeah. your growth as a performer from Francis to Diane?
I think really big because my confidence has changed. I've matured more as a performer. And I think cause just the more you do it, the better you get just through practice. And my hope is that to look back at my time now in 5 years and think I've improved too. Like I think the learning never stops. I also think performing on stage is something that gets better with age and with like weight, you know, with the experiences that you have in your real life. You just become more grounded and you just know your style more. So I would say a big leap from Diane to Francis, without much work, but not what am I trying to say? It took a lot of work still. It didn't happen naturally, but yeah, I'm very proud with the differences between the shows, and I hope to keep improving as future shows come along.
Do you think that when you decide that Francis should come to an end of its run before you move on to the next project, that you would do like a filmed performance of it for your website or for YouTube or a pay-to-watch situation for your fans? who can't make it to the stage?
That's such a good question. It's something that that's in the back of my mind, and I don't really know. It's been filmed. It's definitely not the sort of film quality I would like get people to pay for. So then, I don't know. I think I have to tour it more and get it seen more before deciding to put it up. Like maybe I'll put some clips up or something, but I really love to keep it for the people who are there in the room.
Yeah.
It's just a different experience. I don't know if that sounds
like, I mean, I think it also makes sense. All the racist jokes only make sense when you're there in the theater, you know? Because you collect the phones when they enter the theater.
That's right. Nobody can ever say what, and I make them sign NDAs. There's a lot of nudity. A lot. Just
mostly, like, the photos are the only things that aren't nude about this whole show.
Exactly. It's like I get dressed for the photos. Oh, you know me too well.
You get dressed ironically, yeah.
Ironically. It's ironic to wear clothes. Yeah, I'm not wearing pants right now. Yeah.
you did an episode of What We Do in the Shadows, this great effects comedy. Do you have more on screen goals as opposed to on stage goals?
You know, I always thought that social media would be temporary. I love making videos for online videos. It's the best. I think as time goes on, I would love to transition more to more traditional and established media, but like my dream of dreams is to be able to keep writing shows and touring shows and then deciding to like stop touring for a time and work on either someone else's project, like be in someone else's project or do my own, and whether that's social media or something else, we'll have to see. But I think touring and performing live is definitely my number one priority.
There's nothing like that feeling. There's nothing like that feeling. The spotlight on, the audience enjoying it, hearing the feeling the room, like the buzz of the room.
Yeah.
There is nothing
like that. It's a drug.
It's a drug, definitely.
It's a drug.
Yeah.
It's a drug.
And I mean, you can get kind of like, you know, little mini doses of that with, you know, seeing reactions to videos or, you know, appearing in certain programs, whether that's TV or film, and, you know, hearing, you know, people watching it, oh, it's getting good reviews, whatever. Like, you can get touches of that, but there's nothing like that live instantaneous reward of people clapping and singing along or you know, or laughing in your case to what you're giving you, that instant gratification.
Totally. Also that instant non-gratification, like, you'll just instantly know if something worked or didn't, and then you'll be able to change it. With like social media and pre-shooting and doing takes and everything, it's like the people that like it will like it, but you, you know, you won't necessarily know immediately whether something works or not. And in the room, it's undeniable. It's like objective. Right. I know they say comedy is subjective, but I think in the room with a group of people, totally objective. Like, it either is funny or it's not.
It's very binary. There's either a laughing human or not.
Yes.
And it really, it hits everything.
Drama.
Is that still something that you would like to try and dip your toe in eventually, whether it's on stage or on screen for any thing?
I think I do a lot. I do a lot of that in the show because it just makes things better. But I don't think so. I think comedy is where it's at. Maybe, but it's not in my plan.
Yeah.
How about you?
I could dig some drama. I can imagine. What I like is, I mean, it's kind of cliche, but I really like how Adam Sandler did like the early 2000s.
Yeah.
You know, you can do your Happy Gilmores, your Billy Madisons, your Mr. Deeds, your Big Daddies, but then do Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah.
You know? Or then go do, you know, 50 First Dates, but then do, what's it called? Spanglish.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, that's, you know, he's still a lovable, flawed person, but he's trying. It feels authentic. Of course, later you have Uncut Gems, but like, when he's in a more, or even Funny People from Apatow, like, he's funny in Funny People, but he's also dying. So there's a lot of heartfelt, intimate scenes with him that you love it. I love it.
Yeah, I think especially stuff like something you wouldn't consider a hard comedy, but it's, I mean, like a White Lotus, that would be a dream to be in that kind of a show where, I mean, you've got characters that are so character that could almost be sketch characters, but the narrative and the story, and they're played so earnestly. I think that's the kind of dramedy I would enjoy doing for sure.
Yeah. That would be a dream to do some sort of satire like that.
Yeah.
God. Is there anything else besides, we can wrap things up soon, but do you have anything else besides White Lotus that you've seen recently that you suggest?
We just started watching the other two.
With Molly Shannon, right?
Yes. And the writing is really good. I was, I'd heard good things about it, but I don't know why I never really put it on until randomly the other day. And just immediately you can tell that the writing and the writing room is so on. That's one I've been really enjoying lately.
That's awesome. I was trying to think if I had anything to suggest. I mean, have you seen Dave?
No.
That first season of Dave is pristine. I mean, it changes a bit. The tone and his goals change a bit from the second season on, but that first season is so good. For serious things, have you seen Severance? Any chance?
Yes. That was on my list to tell you. Severance is one of those shows. Oh my God. I haven't I just care about all the characters so much.
Yes.
And it's an incredible show. Watch for sure.
I haven't been so in need of another season as much as I was for Severance.
Yeah. And another actor who is known mainly for comedic roles, like even maybe two-dimensional comedic roles. I don't know if that's a wrong thing to say, but he just nails it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, Adam Scott.
Yeah.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was also an impressive turn for him, seeing him in that position.
Yeah.
But yeah, Laura, we can wrap everything up here. I know we have to go, but I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for being on this podcast. It's been so much fun to get to know you. And I know that, your followers are going to be so excited to get to know a bit more about, who you are. And it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad we managed to do this. It's been such a wonderful, like we were just talking, just a wonderful conversation. You're a great interviewer. Thank you for having me.
Look out, baby. The saints are coming.
Artsy Fartsy Immigrants, ein Podcast von John Prinz und Moritz Batscheider, produziert für M94.5.